This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Let's say our object is to understand capitalism. We could very logically begin with capital, the accumulation of which is at the very heart of capitalism. So what is capital and how do we measure it? According to Jonathan Knitson, the answer has never been straightforward. In fact, he argues that capital, which we tend to think of as an economic phenomenon, is not economic, nor a mode of production or consumption at all. Rather, he argues, capital is power. It's a mode of power, and to understand it otherwise gets us confused and off track. Jonathan Knitson is a political science professor at York University in Toronto, Canada, and he's written a book with Shimshon Bichler entitled Capital as Power. An article of the same name, written by the same two scholars, recently appeared online. What it does is go through and evaluate some fascinating political economic history, including what Knitson calls the cosmology of capitalism, the theoretical ideological foundations of the capitalist system. I recently taped a two-part interview with Jonathan Knitson. We will present the first part today and the second part on Wednesday. Now, let me clarify a couple things at the outset. When Knitson says liberal, he doesn't mean liberal as in liberal versus conservative. He's referring rather to the liberal political tradition, which is basically now the mainstream. Another term for mainstream political economy is neoclassical political economy. You'll hear Jonathan use that term as well. Secondly, by Cree order, a word in the subtitle of their book, Capital as Power, Knitson and Bichler mean the process and reality of creating order in society. So, Cree order. Okay, when I spoke with Knitson by phone, I began by asking him about the importance of ideology and theory to the capitalist system.
Well, I think that Marx and Engels expressed it quite well in a book that they wrote called The German Ideology, and they argued that capitalism emerges within and remains intertwined with its theories and ideologies and dogmas. And these theories and dogmas basically emerged in the 18th century by political economy. And political economy was really the first science of society, if you wish. And it was a full-fledged cosmology. It wasn't something narrow. It was kind of a system of thinking that was both totalizing and active. It was totalizing in a sense that, in fact, it dealt with the entire social order. And it also dealt, surprisingly as it may sound to some people, with the interaction of the social order with nature. And also, quite importantly, it was active. The word cosmology is associated with in English, with the Greek term kosmeo, which means essentially to order or to organize. So it's an active thing. So these ideologies and theories and dogmas, they do not only justify the system or critique the system, they in fact actively shape the world in which they exist. So I think that they are extremely important and they are extremely central.
You write that political economy of the mainstream as well as Marxist kinds stands on three foundations, and I want to take them in order. The first that you cite is a separation between economics and politics. And you and Shimshon start this article with some history from the 13th and 14th centuries. What happened back then in Europe?
Well, I mean, we know about this period quite a bit, and it turns out that during that period, there was a sort of a beginning of a transition that was unclear at the time, became clear in retrospect, that was centered on the European bourgs. We're talking, as you mentioned, about 13th, 14th century, maybe even slightly earlier. And during this period, we see the emergence of some sort of a new urban order that was ruled by what eventually became capitalists. So these were the owners of the factories, they were the industrialists, and most importantly, they were really social innovators. So these capitalists and the Bourges introduced a new way of organizing society that was explicitly economic, in inverted commas. And it was lying in very sharp contrast to the feudal landscape in which they were embedded. So instead of the vertical relations of feudalism, they offered really a flat society. And this society basically was based not on privilege, but it was based on productivity. And it resisted authoritarianism in favor of individualism. There was a lot of emphasis on progress as compared to the sort of ignorance that was instilled by feudal rule. It was not subservient, it was emphasizing opportunity. But I think most importantly, it basically broke the closed loop that characterized feudalism, where distribution is essentially based on confiscation. So what I have is based on what I take from you. And the new urban order of the Bourg offered something that never existed in the history of humanity, and that's open-ended growth. In other words, that the pie itself is expanding, and that was something completely novel. Now, I think that quite a lot of the duality of economics and politics that we see today is traceable to that period.
So in other words, you have this emerging bourgeoisie, and then you have the feudal nobility, and somehow the dynamics between them created or originated some kind of separation?
It was more or less like that, in the sense that the Bourges accepted, at least in the beginning, the feudal rule, especially in terms of religion and in terms of war. And the capitalists very much tried to imitate the honorific attributes of the feudal lords, etc. But they also demanded something that we called the sort of extra economic zones. They demanded what they termed libertates. In other words, they demanded to have differential exemptions. And these libertates, of course, eventually turned into the universal liberty that we now speak of. But originally, they were thought of as differential kind of power exemptions, that I do not have to pay taxes and I do not have to pay levies and so on. And that demand was a demand essentially for separating feudal politics from so-called bourgeois economics, in other words, the feudal landscape from the Bourges. In other words, there was the beginning of a class struggle, if you like, between the eventually declining nobility and the rising bourgeoisie. And when we speak about politics and economics today as separate realms, that is traceable to that period, to that struggle.
So what have mainstream political economists lumped more recently under the banner of the economy, and what have they considered as belonging to the realm of politics?
Right. So they had about 600 years or more to idealize this difference that at the time was very clear, sort of geographical difference, and they abstracted it. So nowadays, when you speak about the economy, you intuitively mean production. You speak about well-being, technology, trade, income, profit. All of those things are thought of as belonging to economy. Politics is where you lump state, law, army, violence. And the economy is usually thought of as the productive source. This is where freedom is generated. This is the realm of rationality. This is where people are frugal and think about the future. And it's the dynamic sphere. And politics is thought of in sort of opposite terms. It's thought of as being coercive and collective, and people speak about the inherent corrupt nature of politics and how it's wasteful and conservative. So we have sort of the source of utility is the economy, the source of well-being is the economy, and politics is some sort of a parasitical entity that taxes, that intervenes, that distorts the economy.
The economy should be left alone.
Exactly. The idea is that the best type of society is one in which you have the maximum economics and the least amount of politics.
Jonathan Knitson is his name. He's an associate professor of political science at York University in Toronto. He's co-author with Shimshon Bichler of the book Capital as Power, A Study of Order and Cree Order. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Now, the Marxist view on economics and politics and their separation is different. What do Marxists think of the idea of setting the private economy off and apart from the politics of the state and of the public sphere?
I think that Marx and the Marxists take a very different view of this separation, but it's not entirely different. What they argue is that the separation is really a fiction. It's an invention of the bourgeoisie, that it's not a reality, but it is a necessary fiction. In other words, this fiction is not some sort of a whim of the capitalists. It's something that serves a purpose. And the purpose that the separation, or the fictitious separation between these two realms, is to alienate private property, to put it outside the public domain. And when you do that, you serve the interest of capitalists, because their property becomes uncontestable. And therefore, what Marx saw as the collective pursuit of a free society is essentially inhibited by this fictitious separation. So for Marx and the Marxist, I think the independence of the political and legal sphere is not at all a distortion or an inconsistency as it is for mainstream liberal political economy, but it's actually a prerequisite, and it's a necessity. Without it, there could be no capitalist economics and no capitalism at all. So I think that whereas liberals, and I mean liberals in general sense, not in the political sense that it's understood in the United States, they see political power as distorting economic well-being. For the Marxists, they actually see a mutual reinforcement between two forms of power. You have the economic power of exploitation, and you have the political power of oppression. But these two forms of power are not symmetric for the Marxist, because in Marxism, the nature of the state eventually, and there are differences in opinion, but ultimately it's predicated on the economic requirements of surplus extraction and of accumulation. If I may give you a few examples to clarify what I mean. In the 19th century, capital accumulation demanded laissez-faire. So it demanded no or minimal government intervention. But if you fast forward into the, say, 1950s and 60s, then it was Keynesianism that was required for capital accumulation. And if you fast even forward to the present, then it's financialized liberalism. So every time the political regime, so to speak, adjusts itself to the requirements of the economy. And that means that the state and the political realm is necessary, but it's necessary only insofar as it's subjugated to some extent to the economic realm, and that means that the two need to be distinct. So we do have here a distinction still, although the distinction is thought of as being a fiction in a way, in the way that liberal political economy presents it, it's nonetheless necessary.
A second foundation of political economy, a mainstream as well as Marxist, is, you write, a Galilean, Cartesian, Newtonian mechanical understanding of the economy. Now, remind us of the main features of this mechanical worldview.
I think it's useful to remember that the capitalist order emerged together, in fact, in the midst of the mechanical worldview of the political scientific revolution that started maybe in the 16th, around the 16th century. And it's useful to mention some of the key elements, or the key figures, rather, or the heroes of that revolution. It starts with people like Machiavelli, and it goes with Kepler and Galileo, and then Descartes and Hobbes and Locke, Hume, Leibniz, and of course, the most important of all is Newton. Now, we often hear that social scientists constantly borrow their concepts and try to imitate the natural sciences. And that is, of course, true, but I think the influence goes, in fact, both ways, and it's not clear which is more important. I think more are both of them are important. And again, a few illustrations to flesh out this bidirectional influence. If we think of the notion of force that was developed by Galileo and Newton, well, both of them were incredibly influenced by the book that Machiavelli wrote, The Prince. The Prince is motivated by secular force. In other words, not by the general good of society, but by power for the sake of power. And The Prince follows calculated rationality. Now, these ideas are social ideas, but they're very much, if you like, influenced or even determined the way that Galileo and Newton tried to formulate their ideas about force. Similar with Thomas Hobbes, who spoke about a mechanical human being. It was fashioned after Galileo's pendulum. But that pendulum itself is a reflection of a society that is increasingly pervaded by machines and technical gadgets. Or if we take Newton's idea of independent bodies that populate the universe, this is a reflection, I think, of the increasing individualism in the society in which he lived. The universe that he describes is a liberal universe. Every entity in that universe, every particle, every heavenly body is a lonely soul of the in the cosmos, if you like. Newton does not indicate ultimate cause. It's never A causing B. It's always, in Newton, interaction, interdependence. So it's a very liberal cosmos that he's describing. We can mention a few others. For example, Descartes. Descartes completely rejected the idea of action at a distance. And the reason he rejected action in the distance, and we're talking about the cosmos, is because he contested the idea of religious mystery and religious miracles. He didn't want the cosmos to have anything to do with it. Final example is Darwin. Darwin's idea of natural selection, which is the mainstay of biology today, is basically borrowed wholesale from Thomas Malthus's population theory. So we have a whole set of scientific ideas, all of them embedded in and to a great extent influenced by the politics or the social order of the time.
So how do these scientific social notions of the universe acting in a kind of mechanical machine-like way, how do they square with the ideal society as envisioned by the mainstream political economists?
I think that this kind of bidirectional influence is not at all unique to capitalism. I mean, throughout history, we see that human beings always politicize nature. They always impose their own politics on the universe that surrounds them, and that starts from the ancient societies of Sumer and Egypt, in which the structure of the cosmos is essentially the structure of the state. But it goes all the way to capitalism. It's fairly easy to illustrate if you think about the science that developed around that period. The liberal scientific god for all these scientists was nothing but absolute rationality. It was simply natural law. The language of this god is mathematical. The universe of this god is numerical. It's a flat universe, as I mentioned. Every body is kind of sitting in equal relation with other bodies. And the interaction is not hierarchical. It's not differential. Everybody obeys the same universal law, which is gravity. And the movement is all about the invisible forces and counterforces that essentially define the Newtonian container. And if you think about the way that liberal political economy developed, it's almost a mirror image. Liberal society is a collection of actors. We know the famous expression by Margaret Thatcher, who said that, I remember, there is no such thing as a society. There are only individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So we are talking about a collection of actors that are independent of one another. They're all too small to have any impact on each other and therefore on the grander scheme of things. They are energized not by some patriarchal obligations, but by scarcity. So for liberal political economy, scarcity is the gravitational force of society, is what brings people together. And then the attraction and repulsion, again, are driven by utilitarian forces, which are supply and demand, and they are universal everywhere. There's no hierarchy, there's no feudal decree. So order is created not from above, but by the invisible hand of perfect competition. So what we have here, essentially, in capitalism is, if you like, a socio-physical cosmos, that both sides of this cosmos are mechanical, they are both equilibrating, both are rational.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Jonathan Nitzan is my guest, Nitzan. He teaches political economy at York University in Toronto. He recently co-wrote an article with Shimshon Bichler called Capital as Power that appeared recently in the online magazine Philosophers for Change. And the larger volume of work that he has produced with Mr. Bichler is called Capital as Power, A Study of Order and Cree Order. That was a book published in 2009. We've put a link to a free downloadable PDF of it on againstthegrain.org, where we've also put a link to the article that we are discussing today. So, Jonathan, a third foundation of political economy is a value theory that breaks the economy into two spheres, real and nominal. This is an argument you make in your article. And here we get into theories of value on which both mainstream and Marxist political economies are founded. What, in general, is a theory of value? And tell us about the two spheres that are dominant.
Okay, well, I mean, we need to remember that capitalism is a system of commodity. So it is universalized by prices. To understand it, we need to understand prices, and it's therefore not surprising that both liberal mainstream political economy and Marxist political economy are founded on theories of value. We have the utility theory of value of the neoclassicist or the liberal, and we have the labor theory of value of Marxist. And these theories essentially rest on the presumption that the economy itself is made of two quantitative spheres, real and nominal. And the real one is the important one. This is where all the action takes place. This is where production and consumption, utility, exploitation, surplus, value, profit, all of these things are created in the real sphere. Now, the problem with assuming that this real sphere is quantitative is that all of these productive, consumptive entities are different from one another. So goods and services, labor, machines, structures, all of those things are qualitatively different. How do you bring them into common denominator? Well, the physicists have a solution for that. They have so-called fundamental quantities. So they have distance, time, mass, electrical charge, heat, five fundamental quantities, and everything in the physical universe is some combination or relationship between these fundamental quantities. For example, velocity is time divided by distance, or acceleration is time derivative of velocity, etc. Now, the economists try to do the same thing. They argue that they have their own fundamental quantities. The liberals call it the util, and the Marxists call it socially necessary abstract labor time. And the claim that both of these approaches make is that any real entity can be converted to these units. So, for example, if you have two machines, you can denominate each one of them in terms of the socially necessary abstract labor time they took to produce. And then if one is, you know, 100 hours and the other is 50, then the quantities are 2-to-1 in terms of the ratio, and you can do the same thing in terms of the utils they generate. So by converting every qualitative entity into the contents in terms of utils or in socially necessary abstract labor, you essentially quantify the real economy.
What is a util?
A util is something that was invented at the end of the 19th century by the American economist Irving Fisher. And Essentially, it's a unit of hedonic pleasure. Economists have since then tried to devise some sort of machinery to connect to the brain to measure it. But of course, all of this has been an utter failure. So it's a fiction. But nevertheless, all of economics is based on it.
So in other words, you produce something and that something produces a certain kind of hedonic pleasure in the eventual user, and that's the quantitative measure that determines the utils that come out of that process.
Precisely. Yeah. So every entity is designed to produce that outcome, and the outcome can be measured in universal units of utils. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but essentially this is the elementary particle of the liberal universe.
And for the Marxists, they point to, as you said, socially necessary abstract labor, which in a nutshell is sort of the labor that goes into making a certain product. And if they can determine that abstract labor, then they somehow are able to, again, quantify that process, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, correct.
Now, before we get into your evaluation of utils and socially necessary abstract labor, what's the nominal realm of the economy?
We have a real sphere which is supposedly quantitative through that mechanism, and the nominal sphere is understood as the world of prices, of money and finance. Now, this is thought of as being a giant mirror or kind of a reflector. Everything here is expressed in dollar prices, and it's supposedly reflecting, either accurately or not so accurately, the real quantities of the real sphere. So, for example, if a car costs $20,000, and an iPhone costs $1,000, an economist might say, well, these ratios represent 20 to 1 the socially necessary abstract labor contents of these two things, or the util contents of these two things. So the nominal sphere is a price map, if you like, of the real sphere. So we have two quantitative realms that supposedly mirror each other. Now, because the laws that govern this correspondence, whether this correspondence is natural in the liberal case or historical, because Marx spoke about historical laws of motion, these laws are thought of being immutable, then the value theorist essentially comes and say, I'm going to discover how those laws operate. In other words, I'm going to discover this correspondence and the rules that determine that correspondence, and this is the purpose of value theory. Value theory explains what happens in the real world by looking at the nominal world.
So value theory then, if I'm correct, depends on us believing or depends on the valid existence of these utils or socially necessary abstract labor. What is your assessment of these so-called fundamental quantities?
Well, I think that nobody has ever been able to actually see the quantities of the real sphere of the economy. And I think that they are, even conceptually, they are impossible units. So I think that what happens, that if we are to explain the nominal appearance of prices by using quantities that we cannot measure, we are in trouble.
So in other words, you contend that no one has ever been able to actually measure concretely the number of utils that go into something or the amount of abstract labor that goes into something?
Correct. I mean, people claim to have, but I don't think they have. I think they've gone in reverse. They look at prices and they say, because something is twice as expensive, it contains twice as many utils, but that could not and never has been confirmed in any way. And the same thing with socially necessary abstract labor times. So the answer is yes, nobody has ever been able to do it.
So what are the implications of this for value theory in general?
Well, maybe we are sort of running a little bit ahead of our story here, but essentially value theory as it stands, I think, is impossible.
And yeah, we are going to talk about the implications of that in some detail. Jonathan Knitson teaches political economy at York University in Toronto. He joins us on Against the Grain. I want to ask you about if we go back to these three foundations of capitalist cosmology, which are the separation of economics and politics and the mechanical understanding of the economy and the breaking up of the economy into the real and nominal spheres, You write that these three foundations of this cosmology began to disintegrate in the second half of the 19th century. What happened?
Yes, this is quite a fascinating story, in fact. And it leads back to the previous question that you asked me, what do I think about this separation? And I said it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is, in some sense, because capitalism has become victorious. Capitalism produced a political economy, the first science of society. And political economy is the first ideology, I think, that substituted secular for religious force. It's the first time that human beings thought about the world in secular terms, really. But the force that political economy spoke about was still heteronomous. It was something that came from outside of society. It was objective. And what happened with the victory of capitalism over feudalism is that there was a growing realization over time that force doesn't have to come from without the economy, but it could come from within. In other words, instead of heteronomous force, there was the possibility of autonomous power, power that is originated within the system. And that changed everything, because the three foundations of political economy that you just mentioned were quite seriously undermined by this autonomous power, the duality of politics, economics, the mechanical worldview, and the real nominal bifurcation, basically cannot work if you have internal power, because the automaticity of this mechanism can no longer be ascertained. And if you don't have an automatic mechanism, then you cannot speak about objective science. And political economy saw itself as an objective science. So essentially, what happened with the recognition of autonomous power is that it was a major challenge to the scientific basis of political economy.
What forms of autonomous power stand out to you as emerging such that these three foundations were undermined?
Right. There were many developments that started to unravel in the second half of the 19th century and were intensified during the 20th century. And I'll mention several of them, maybe three or four. First, we have completely new units. Remember that the classical political economist was denominated an atomistic independent entities, either actors or heavenly bodies. But suddenly we have large hierarchical organizations. We have big business, we have large unions, we have large governments. And these are very large entities, and they affect their own circumstances as well as the circumstances of other units. So automaticity is out the window. So that's one thing. Then we have a whole slew of new phenomena that were completely unknown to the classical political economy. They were historically new, and all of them were antithetical to automaticity. For example, we have the emergence of total war, and we have subsequently the emergence of what people started to call a permanent war economy. That was something that the classicists didn't know of. And, of course, that has nothing to do with automaticity. Then we have large-scale government policy, both at the very disaggregate level as well as the aggregate level. But if you have governments, quote-unquote, intervening, I mean, automaticity is no longer a relevant assumption to make.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the corporation itself is a major blow to automaticity. It became a bureaucratic organization since the turn of the 20th century. And Marx was the first one to identify this, and he thought that incorporation actually is the end of private capital. So again, this is something that upsets the automaticity. A lot of the theories were, at least the Marxist ones, were based on simple labor and subsistence. And all of a sudden, we see labor becoming more complex, and we see rising standards of living, certainly in the 20th century. So subsistence as an automatic regulator of the system, again, is out the window. In fact, since Engels, we start speaking about a labor aristocracy. So if you have a labor aristocracy, then other issues come into the fore, such as culture. You know, how do you incorporate them into the automaticity of the system? Inflation and finance became sort of autonomous creatures that have no connection to the so-called real economy. Again, so these new phenomena threw, I think, political economy off balance in many respects. And in addition to that, towards the middle of the 20th century, we have, with the rise of fascism and Nazism, we have new concepts that emerge that compete with the traditional concepts of political economy, masses, power, state, bureaucracy, elites, systems. All of these concepts are now in competition with class and production. So you have a much more complex picture to deal with. And finally, in this kind of long answer, we have the rise of anti-science sentiments, and we have the rise of sort of all sorts of postist discourses. And that has to do with the second scientific revolution that introduced things such as uncertainty or relativity or the entanglement of object and subject. And all of those things in physics kind of percolated to the social sciences, and in fact also in the other direction. The instability, if you like, of the 20th century percolated into science, but they fermented an anti-scientific, vitalistic, if you like, sentiment, and again, in a way, undermined the scientific basis of political economy. And I think that the net consequence of this victory of capitalism is that capitalism became ever more universal, but the theories of capitalism that originally came and sort of batched together in political economy started to disintegrate. And that's the kind of the bottom line of this process. We don't have any more political economy. There are no departments for political economy anymore, and if there are, they are kind of very artificial creatures. What we have is numerous social sciences. We have a huge fracture. Initially, economics broke from political science to have two different departments in the end of the 19th century, and then we have sociology, anthropology, psychology. And subsequently, we started to have other things, completely new things, management, IR, international relations, culture, gender, communication, and so on and so forth. And all of these start to have their own bureaucracy, their own academic hierarchies, their own concepts. They're all fractured. Now, economists have monopolized the study of capital and the study of accumulation, and they try to shield it from this onslaught of power, of autonomous power, but they really didn't succeed.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We are joined this hour by Jonathan Knitson, who is an associate professor of political science at York University in Toronto. The book he wrote with Shimshon Bichler is Capital as Power, A Study of Order and Creorder. And he's also co-author with Bichler of The Global Political Economy of Israel. Bichler teaches political economy at colleges and universities in Israel. We have links to Jonathan and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. We'll take a short music break and return and speak more with Jonathan Knitson. Please stay with us. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and KPFA.org. Jonathan Knitson teaches political economy at York University in Toronto. We are talking about an article he wrote with Shimshon Bichler called Capital as Power, which is based on the book the two of them wrote called Capital as Power, A Study of Order and Creorder. And I'm delighted to have Jonathan join me by phone from Toronto today. Now, you write that the actual pattern of the capitalist order is created through capitalization, and we've all heard that word before, and it sounds like some kind of process through which at least corporations go through. What, in your mind, is capitalization, and how has it developed or changed?
capitalization is the key capitalist ritual. And the key is the emphasis here. Essentially, it's a symbolic financial procedure that capitalists are conditioned to follow when they discount risk-adjusted future earnings to their present value. And maybe I can explain that in a little bit more technical details in a moment, but I think it's kind of important to understand that this process that every capitalist uses, and in fact all of us use, whether we know it or not, has a very, very long history. It started in the capitalist bourgeois that I mentioned earlier, perhaps sometimes around the 14th century, even earlier, but initially it was dormant because of the religious opposition to usury. It was only with the glorious revolution of the 17th century that this opposition was relaxed somewhat, and the bankers started to use it as a standard practice. But they followed mostly rules of thumb, and it was only in the middle of the 19th century that a group of German foresters for the first time sat down and mathematized the process of capitalization. They gave it a mathematical form. And then if we advance a little bit more, maybe another 50 years, at the beginning of the 20th century, theories such as Irving Fisher, the American economist, gave it a theoretical and ideological foundation for the first time. So that's about a century ago. 50 years later, for the first time, the ideas of capitalization start to appear in textbooks, so they became mainstream. And if we fast forward to the present, capitalization, in fact, has become the most powerful faith on earth. And what that means is that it has more followers than all of the world religions combined. Now, it works in a way that example can illustrate. For instance, if a capitalist considers buying or selling a share of Exxon that is expected to generate, say, $100 of earnings a year from here to eternity, and the discount rate is 10% or 0.1, then the capitalist will capitalize this asset at $1,000. So $100 of earning over $1,000 of capitalization gives you 10%. The expected earnings are made of two components. They are partly objective, so that's the actual earnings that will mature in the future, which are not known now, and the optimism or pessimism of the capitalist. So if the capitalist, say, is very optimistic and the earnings in the future will be only $50, but the capitalist expect 100, as I suggested, then we would say that the capitalist is hyped, and the hype coefficient is 2 in this case. If the capitalist is overly pessimistic and say the hype coefficient is 0.5, although the earnings will be 50, the expected earnings are only 25. So we have two components here. And then the discount rate is again divided into two components. One is the so-called normal rate of return. So that's the yield on, say, a safe asset such as a Swiss government bond, say 5%. And then there's a risk factor, because an Exxon share is more risky than a Swiss government bond. So if the risk factor is 2, say, 5% times 2 will be 10%. So what we have essentially is a formula that has what we called four elementary particles: future earnings, hype, risk, and a normal rate of return. And that formula basically is conditioned, wired into the heads, pocket calculators, models. Everything that capitalists do is denominated in these ways.
So what's capitalization's relationship to real capital?
That's an interesting question. The neoclassicists and Marxists recognize this ritual. They don't call it a ritual, but they recognize its existence. But because they believe in real capital, they don't know exactly what to do with it. And the neoclassicists say, okay, well, the capitalization is supposed to reflect the real capital, but that's just in theory, because in practice we have unfortunate distortions and imperfections, so that's why it does not. And the Marxists go in the other direction. They say, well, this is fictitious capital. It has nothing to do with real capital, but because they need to hang on to the labor theory of value, they concede that occasionally capitalization has to come to equality with real capital, either by expanding through an asset bubble or crushing through a crash that we had over the past 10 years. Now, I think that this is a problematic view for two reasons. Why is that we don't know what real capital is because we can't measure it. Nobody has ever been able to. And second, it really doesn't matter because, in our view at least, capitalization has little to do with economics. It is about power.
Elaborate on that.
All right. Well, in standard parlance, capitalization is about sort of economic conditions. But we think that capitalization is about encompassing everything. Every power process that is seen to affect the future flow of earnings, the hype, the risk, or the normal rate of return, which are the four elements of capitalization, affect capitalization. And anything that affects capitalization is capitalized. And whatever gets capitalized becomes part of capital by definition. Let me give you examples on how this capitalization is all about power. For instance, if you take Microsoft, I just checked yesterday, Microsoft has a market capitalization of about $240 billion. Now, imagine for a moment that every government on the planet decides and announces that from tomorrow, it will no longer protect intellectual property rights. Now, that means that anybody can slide in a CD and copy all of Microsoft software rather than buy it. And the consequence is that Microsoft capitalization will collapse. I don't know if to zero, but to a very low number. Now, this difference between $240 billion and the eventually collapsed capitalization suggests that what the capitalization represents is not productivity or ideas or creativity. It represents the ability of Microsoft to have governments protect its intellectual property. So it's about power. Think of what would happen if governments announced that they are no longer going to act as lenders of last resort for the banking system. I mean, the bank capitalization will collapse, in which case, again, we will have to conclude that the banks capitalize the power they have over governments to protect them.
Just to interrupt, but couldn't one just say that the banks use their capitalization, which is an economic phenomenon, to exert power over government policy? I mean, why can't we just say capital and capitalization are economic, but are used, are employed by the owners of that capital, of that capitalization, to effect government policy, to throw their weight around?
Yes, this is, I think, the common perception, that you have an economic entity that is used to exercise power. But what we are trying to argue, and I think we demonstrate that quite conclusively, both empirically but more importantly conceptually, that the capitalization itself is capitalizing nothing but power. And I really challenge anybody to show me that it capitalizes something other than power. So your point is well taken, in a way that if you have a lot of that capitalization, it might actually augment your power to retain your power. But what you capitalize, in fact, is nothing economic, is nothing productive. What you capitalize is only power as a capitalist.
Let's say a corporation capitalizes. So presumably that means infusions of cash, sometimes very large amounts of cash. So can't we at least say that that process itself, dependent on money and investment and infusions of equity, can't we at least say that that process is rooted in something economic?
Well, I don't know what you mean by economic. Economic for me is a conceptual entity that is associated either with a liberal theory or a Marxist theory. So I think that for the past century or so, people have debated quite heatedly without much success what exactly is economic. You know, if you think about intellectual property rights, they're economic. If you think about, take religion, for example. Let me give you an example. How much is religion worth? So according to Cecil Rhodes, religion is actually worth plenty. And what Cecil Rhodes and investors before him and since have done is to buy sort of highly risky assets in so-called emerging markets, say South Africa, and then send in the missionaries. Desmond Tutu used to say that when the whites came to South Africa, they had the Bible and the blacks had the land, and now it's the opposite.
Mm.
So you send in the missionary, and the missionaries pacify the labor force. they regulate the labor force, they condition the labor force, they kind of make the labor force docile and obedient. That reduces risk. As you reduce the risk in the denominator of the capitalization formula, say you reduce it by a factor of four, your assets, your capitalization rise by a factor of four. In that sense, your assets capitalize religion. So what we are trying to say is that if you take any asset and you try to strip it, you try to figure out what exactly does it capitalize, you end up with it capitalizing only power. Even if we deal with so-called economic processes of production, production itself cannot be capitalized. What you can capitalize is only the power that is associated with or emanates from production. If you produce something for free, you cannot capitalize it.
That is part one of an interview I conducted recently with Jonathan Nitzan, N-I-T-Z-A-N. He's a political science professor at York University. He is co-author with Shimshon Bichler of the book Capital as Power, A Study of Order and Creorder. We've put links on againstthegrain.org to that book, to a recent article penned by Nitzan and Bichler, and to other resources. On Wednesday, we will present part two of the interview, in the course of which Nitzan makes a distinction between industry and business. He argues against the notion that the goal of the capitalist is to maximize profit, and he describes the relationship between Middle East conflicts and the revenues of large oil companies. We also discuss in more detail his and Shimshon's main thesis that capital is not a narrow economic entity. Capital does not merely relate to power, but rather capital is power. It is in itself a mode of power. That's part two on this Wednesday's Against the Grain. This is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. We are on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.